Charlie Kirk is the kind of guy who goes on a college campus, sets up a big sign that says, socialism is evil, prove me wrong, and then takes every kind of wacko, left-wing, curveball, outrageous question that you can imagine, and he fields all of them. And here's the surprising part, he doesn't back down, and that's why I appreciate him and why I hedge on today. Hey, Charlie.
Thank you. Glad to be here. Thank you.
Tell me about Turning Point USA a little bit. I know you're on college campuses, but lately you're also expanding on the high school
campus. That's right. Yeah, we're on pace at 1,000 high school chapters across the country. Look, Turning Point USA, we exist to help pass down American values from one generation to the other. We fight as hard as we do, and we fight to win at Turning Point USA to make sure your kids and grandkids live in a free country. If your kids and grandkids don't share your values or some semblance of American values, then will America continue to exist? And that's a question we all need to ask ourselves. And we're making something happen every single day. We're not just talking about it. We're in the trenches to make sure this beautiful constitutional republic remains.
I saw a video where you went to London. You set up the sign I mentioned at the top of this, and a student came by, took the sign, and walked off with it, which struck me as ironically a perfect example of socialism in action.
Yeah, they take your stuff without your consent, and everybody's unhappy.
Why do you call it Turning Point? I've heard about it for years, but I've never heard anybody answer that question. Why did you pick that name?
Yeah, so I started it in June of 2012, same name for 10 years. I think we're at a generational turning point. We can go the ways of Marxism, collectivism, postmodernism, secularism, or we can recommit ourselves to the idea of a constitutional republic, one that believes in liberty and freedom. And I'm increasingly optimistic that the people of this country are starting to rise up.
I love watching you take the questions from the students on campus. And my initial thought was, I'll do that. I'll make a list of the hardball questions that they throw you and get you to answer them. I thought, what I really want to do to help our audience understand what's going on campus is ask you some questions, because you have a unique vantage point to look into the psyche of campus dwellers all over the country, all over the world for that matter. And we have a need to try to reach into those lives and try to reach them with a message and influence them. So I want to get you to help us understand what it's like inside the head of a college student these days. So first, describe how students today view the concept of free speech.
Yeah, so when I talk about this, this is going to be the majority of students, not all students, okay?
It's a broad brush.
Yeah, so, I mean, our students at Turning Point USA don't share this. But, yeah, most young people believe free speech is not a value worth preserving. Most young people believe free speech is something that allows for hate and offensive ideas to continue. Again, not all young people, but a vast majority do. And it's a serious problem. And there's a reason why they believe that. They believe that disagreement must lead to offense, and when you're offended, you must silence. Therefore, disagreement must lead to complete and total silencing. And that sort of equation, that kind of repetition of that belief system, is totalitarian in nature. It shouldn't strike anybody as too surprising. But that is some of the beliefs that are inculcated on these college university campuses.
And from the beginning of trying to interact, it says you're not worth talking to.
Yeah, that's right. And so they also don't believe that we're all made in the image of God. They don't believe we're image bearers. They don't believe in God. So it's a hyper-secular society, so they don't really know what a human being is. They don't believe human beings have souls. They believe most of life is a power dynamic, who's in charge and who's actually controlling things. They don't believe in the fruits of the Enlightenment, of separation of powers or consent to the governed. It's instead that I'm in control or you're in control and I want the power. And I know that seems like an oversimplification, but that's exactly what is being taught in our university campuses.
And that sets up the next question I've got on my list here. What do they see as the proper role of government?
An unlimited role of government. Again, this is the majority, not everyone, but they believe in a strong, heavy hand of government. They believe that the individual is not sovereign. They do not believe rights come from God. And why I say they believe, I'm talking about the vast viewpoint, right? So there's plenty of exceptions and nuance here, but this is the consensus. The consensus is that rights are administered by the state, and that we, the citizens, are actually not citizens, we're more like subjects that live under the kind of reign of this totalitarian type system. And so this is kind of this is one of the problems with small L liberalism, is that it will lead you towards this, right? And this is something I try to push back upon in conservatives, where they say, like, we're classically liberal. Be careful with that, because that will soon lead to leftist totalitarianism. You know, you saw this with the homosexual movements, right? The LGBT groups at first was all about, like, liberating disadvantaged groups. But as soon as you unshackle the groups, which there might be a good argument to do that if they were even shackled at all, they will have a clenched fist and invoke revenge upon the people they thought that wronged them. So it's not even about transgenderism anymore. It's now forcing people to subscribe to the same sort of belief that you believe in. And so
and controlling what you say. I mean, yeah, so language. Much of this has to do with me controlling, me being the student, controlling the language that comes out of your mouth.
That's right. And so, you know, there's this idea that young people really want to be free. That's just not true. Human beings don't want to be free. The Bible tells us that. Some people like to be free based on their nature. It's a very small percentage. Freedom must be taught. It's a value like anything else. And if it's not taught, the normal condition is to sit around and do really kind of nothing. It's to be sedentary, to be taken care of. Liberty and freedom is a offshoot of the biblical construct. That if you are free in Christ, if your spirit demands to be free, then you want to live free in the earthly domain as well. But if you have no God, then why would you demand freedom? And that's why the most secular societies in America are increasingly unfree.
First Liberty Institute, of course, is a nonprofit law firm that exclusively does religious freedom cases. Thanks for that. When they hear that religious freedom is a constitutionally protected right, what goes through their head?
Probably they think that's an outdated, antiquated belief. And look, I go a step further, and Kelly smiles when I say this, which is I don't believe in religious freedom for Satanists. I don't. Religious freedom means Christian freedom and Jewish freedom and other types of religions that I think are acceptable. But we should totally ban Satanists from the public square. Again, Kelly doesn't have an opinion on this.
Opinions heard on this.
But what I'm saying, though, is that, like, they believe in, like, child pedophilia, and they call themselves a religion. So, and I know why First Liberty has to say what you say and all that, but no, like, that's not a religion. It's not. And so we cloak Christian liberty under religious freedom, and I think that's helpful in the courts, but I refuse to believe the Founding Fathers thought the fruits of liberty would include the American Satanist Convention.
A couple days ago, you tweeted out a single sentence. You wrote, quote, "There are only two genders," unquote. It got retweeted 2,000 times. It got 14,000 likes. Are students buying into that philosophy as much as we're being led to believe, the one that you're responding to with that sentence?
Oh, yeah. No, I mean, the vast majority believe gender is a social construct. They believe there's nothing affirming or anchoring to gender. And even the ones that disagree, they're afraid to talk about it.
And that's what I think I'm getting at, is there's this sense on campus, because of all the other things you said, I may not agree, but if I speak up, I'm going to get squashed. So I'm not going to say,
right.
I'm going to act as if I believe, even if I don't.
Yeah, a lot of life is in the nuance. You guys know this with the great work you do at First Liberty. It's in the actual specifics of the case, time, place, circumstance, and manner.
Yeah.
And so there are some young people that might say, oh, you know, we need to treat transgender people better, but it's probably gone too far. There's a lot of people in that kind, but they would never say that. They would just be like, okay, I'm on team totalitarian, like, just leave me alone, I'm gonna live my life.
What does that lead to when that's the standard operating procedure, when people say, I'm just not gonna rock the boat?
The country's done. Civilization ends. That's about it.
It's a dark future you're looking at,
no,
but that's where we
optimistic.
Are
right
now.
I'm optimistic because people are starting to push back and citizens are starting to rise. But I'm also very honest with listeners that if you don't, the whole thing ends. This experiment we're living through, this American project, it can collapse pretty quickly. I mean, we're seeing it in a lot of different ways.
Yeah.
And it only is alive based on the prayers and the actions of the faithful and the liberty loving. And that's an increasingly small group in America.
I want to turn this now, and you've covered this really well. Very helpful to get an idea what's going on out there. But to take it in the direction of how do we then start entering the conversation, how do we start reaching? I'm going to start, though, with a typical exchange that I may or may not have had along the way. I assert a point of view. I get called a nasty name, and I get told that I don't have a place to have any an opinion on that subject. So I make a thoughtful and logical response, because I don't feel like we should respond in kind the way that we often are treated. I get called an even nastier name, and then I'm told that I'm the one responsible for people dying. How do we break out of that cycle so that we can have an actual conversation about issues?
Yeah, look, we can only do so much. I mean, I just had an interview with somebody, nice person, that made no sense.
And not this one, I hope.
No, this was great, but they were on my show, and it just really wasn't making any sense, and they were saying some pretty provocative things. And I kept it pretty even cool, and that's only because I've dealt on campus. I've dealt with much worse, right?
Yeah.
And a nice person, truly, but just was really confused on a lot of things. But so it's a lot on us, to be perfectly honest, on how we respond and how we manage it and how we approach it. But I'll also say that they have weaponized name calling. And I'm stunned, I'll be very honest, at how effective it is.
It's crazy effective.
Like, I mean, it's, I could write a whole book on this, really, is like the weaponization of name calling, which is like the tactic a third grader uses is also used by our State Department. And I, you know, what a normal everyday person would be like, oh, what are you, a middle schooler? Like, actually, that psychology hasn't changed.
Yeah.
Right? Like, you're a racist, you're a bigot. It's like the same thing as saying you're mean or you're awful. And it works. That's what's so incredible, is that people will go into like an apologetic posture immediately if you call them like transphobic, whatever that is.
Yeah.
Right? And so, yeah, they've weaponized the insult in a way where they can control society almost hypnotically if they call you especially a racist. That's the one that people's knees just get weak.
And
it's designed
to do that. I mean, that's the purpose Yes. That the name calling shows up.
Oh, that's exactly right. No, it is a tomahawk missile on the American citizen where they just disintegrate if you call them the wrong name. In fact, there are so many overtures and there's so much posturing you have to do to almost prevent against it, to like virtue signal you aren't the thing that they might call you. And so you think about it at a deep level, it's like we're in this mass nationwide paralysis away from truth because we're afraid of being called something bad.
The natural human response is to return the favor, call them a name, Try to get even nastier, escalate it. That doesn't lead to anything good.
No, and I could say the proper response, again, you should care about what some people think. I'm not saying we should be sociopathic, right?
Okay.
Because some people say like, oh, I don't care what anyone says. Like, no, you should care what your wife says and your friends. And every so often, if you hear a criticism, really they say, is that true? No, it's not. And then you could kind of just release it, right?
Yeah.
And I'm not, don't read the Twitter comments or anything. But the rule for life that's worked for me is listen to the people that matter what they tell you. And then you have to know what's true. And then are you still going to say what's true after the backlash? That's what's important, right?
Yeah.
So you must have a statement of beliefs before the criticism. And if it changes after the criticism, then it's being impacted.
Yeah.
Right? Now, there might be, most of the backlash or the criticism I get is all on substance, okay? The criticism I receive is the stylistic. Charlie, you got too emotional. Like, that's actually stuff I'm willing to, you know,
yeah,
play in. Like, but if they say, oh, Charlie, you're a bigot because you said there's two genders, like, have a nice day.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah, you have to have your own internal compass.
That's exactly
so
right.
You know what's right, what's wrong, no matter what somebody
says. I'll receive. I think that's fine.
I was at one of your gatherings here in Nashville, actually, just over a year ago, and I had a conversation back in the back with a couple of students, a young woman, young man, and I got chatting with them, and what they shared with me was this. They were probably about 20. They said when they had come to the college campus, they weren't conservative, they were liberal. But then they started seeing how liberal ideas don't work in the real world.
That's right.
And so it caused them to search a bit. They were being intellectually honest about it. Well, then they looked at conservative ideas. They started seeing they do work. They weren't quite to the point of being ready to say, I'm a conservative, but they were at least willing to hear the conversation,
yes,
and weigh the ideas. How often do you hear that story?
All the time. Thousands of times a week. We have a big audience on our podcast. We've been very blessed. I get people that reach out that disagree with so much I say, then they'll email 6 months later and they disagree a little bit less. And look, I take some very strong stances. I say what I believe, you know, and I'd say that out of our listenership, probably 5% agrees with everything I say. 5%. But they still enjoy because I'll justify it. I'll have reason behind it. And it's also a mishmash at times. People might agree totally on my economic views, but disagree on my social views,
yeah,
right? Or they might agree on my biblical stuff, but they disagree on the foreign policy, whatever it is. But here's what I find, though, is that you must be willing to explain. It's how you communicate it, and it's whether or not someone can say, I can see where you're coming from in that perspective. But we see that all the time, and we see people moving towards that direction.
I work for a law firm that exclusively does religious freedom cases. We said that already. How do we, as an organization, effectively reach out to reach this generation coming up and help them see our point of view on things, our message?
Yeah, look, I mean, I tell this to Kelly, just win, right? It's like the Al Davis thing, just win, baby. Just keep winning cases. That's your mission statement, right? And you guys do a lot communicating this and persuading people, but you guys are the best when you're in a courtroom defending someone who's been wronged. And like that's your lane, and you dominate in that lane. Because the 18-year-old atheist right now at Berkeley who thinks religious freedom's a waste of time, well, 10 years from now, they might give their life to the Lord at a revival in Colorado. They're going to need the work you're doing,
yeah.
Right? And so you're laying that kind of foundation. You're setting the preconditions so that the converted and the Christian can live free. And so you just got to keep on winning cases. You got to keep on finding plaintiffs that have proper complaints, right? You got to keep on making good arguments. And you guys do that better than almost anybody, better than anybody else. I mean, Kelly's been a dear friend. He's been so great to me. And I don't say this about a lot of groups, but First Liberty is like one of the most impactful organizations in America. It really is. And I mean, America's freer today because of First Liberty.
Thank you for the kind words. Appreciate that. I know you've got a full schedule today.
Yes,
anything else you'd like to share before I let you go?
Look, I just think we need to be clear about what liberty is. Kelly and I could have a spirited off-the-camera debate on this. I do not believe liberty means doing whatever you want to do whenever you want to do it. It's the pursuit of what is good, true, and beautiful, and virtuous. And we must be clear about that, is that we want people to live in alignment with their creator. We want people to do things that are meaningful, not be captured by sin or demagoguery, nonsense, or patterns of, you know, let's say destructive pleasure. And so liberty is to set the captives free. That's why Jesus came. He came to set us free from our sins, from eternal bondage. And we're here in the earthly domain to try to allow people to be able to pursue what is virtuous. So that's the fight worth having.
Outstanding. Charlie Kirk,
thank you so much
for making time for
thank
us.
You. Appreciate it.
And we appreciate you sharing with us in these conversations at the NRB Christian Media Convention here in Nashville. We will have more conversations. Just look on FirstLibertyLive.com, and you can pick up on all the interesting people we've talked to.